Today is the 10th of October 2016, and I'm interviewing Doug Begley of Havelock North on the life and times of his family. Doug, would you like to tell us something about your family? Thank you.
Thank you, Frank. Well, our Begley family originates from Ireland, from County Kerry, in a little place called Ballinabrook, which is only about six or seven houses, I gather. And there were five Begley boys and one girl. Four of the boys came to New Zealand. I think they all came at the same time on the City of Auckland in 1878. And the City of Auckland was famous because it was wrecked at Otaki on the 22nd of October. There was no loss of life. It was an error, I gather, from the captain, and they grounded at about 9 o'clock at night, and they were forced to stay on board with the help of the Maoris. Everybody got off the next day and were duly transported to Napier, which was the intended destination. So, incidentally, I digress, but that City of Auckland, Selwyn, my brother, he found out years later that there was the dresser out of the captain's cabin was at the Maori Marae, and Selwyn went to the Marae and bought it off them. This is in probably the late 1980s. It was a real mess, but he got it restored, and Moira, his wife, they still have that cabinet from the captain's cabin of the City of Auckland. So that was their introduction to New Zealand. They got to Napier, as I say, and my grandfather worked for William Nelson most of his early life. He met his wife, my grandmother. She arrived in New Zealand in 1878 in Napier on the May Queen with her brother. She was Ellen Guerin, and her brother was Mick Guerin. The Guerins later became well known in Hawke's Bay too. Mick married a Taranaki girl and then settled farming in Dannyberg in the Descendants. Jack Guerin was well known out at Maraukaka. So my grandparents were married in 1885 at the Miani Church. And my grandmother had worked. I gather that when they'd arrived, they'd go up to a hostel on the hill, at Bluff Hill there. Various farmers would come in and look for domestics and what have you. Initially, she went to a place in Taradale. I often wonder whether it was where the EIT is, that station. Yes. Later, she went to the Beamishes out at Honokonek and then Waimarama Station before she married my grandfather. And as I say, they worked for Nelson's, and actually their first home was on the corner of Lawn Road and Munga Territory, Waimarama Road. As you driving down Lawn Road, it was on the left-hand side. And there used to be a well standing there that we always knew was also it remained.
It was on the right-hand side going or coming?
Going down. If you were going down Lawn Road after you've gone over the intersection, on the left-hand side.
Left opposite Nelson's.
Yes. And he was working, of course, for Nelson. Yes. And grandfather's claim to fame in terms of his time with Nelson was, it was always said that he planted Poplar Avenue. Well, that was a tremendous avenue between Elwood Road and the Parkawai Bridge. And we have two lovely photos of Poplar Avenue, coloured photos, and Oak Avenue, because they were the two avenues in Hawke's Bay. But of course, poplars don't last. So then eventually grandfather went to, or bought a property on the corner of Riversley Road and Elginon Road. I presume they built the house there, and that's where they farmed. And that area is where the Begleys, we all have associations there. As I say, grandfather had the dairy farm there. That's where my father was born. Ultimately, my father farmed at the other end of Elginon Road, at the end of Norton Road, and I was born there. And then I married Dorothy, and we had our first property was in the middle in Elginon Road. And our two boys were born there. Selwyn took over to the end of Norton Road Farm, and most of his family were born there.
You remember Jack McEwen used to be down?
Yeah, well, I was Jack's neighbour.
So that was where the farm It was on the river side of Algernon Road.
No, the farm was on the other side of Algernon Road, the dairy farm. There were 5 acres, which were Algernon Road, the riverside. There were 2 blocks, which were rehab blocks. Yes. They're 5 acres, and I bought one of them in 1954, and that was when I was a neighbour of Jack McEwen. And I digress, but our neighbours as Jack McEwen, and we went later to Te Ati Road. Jack came out to Crystal Road. We were neighbours there. Jack and Elaine went to Whakatane in Rotorua. Jack died, and then Elaine came back to Havelock and was our neighbour here. Reverting to Dad's family, Dad was the youngest of 7, so that was 5 boys and 2 girls. Jack was the eldest. There's Thomas, Patrick, Joe and Dan, and the girls were May and Gertrude. The eldest brother, John, Jack, as he was known, he finished up farming at Puterino, but then he died suddenly, just dropped dead of heart, comparatively young age, perhaps early 50s. Michael, although he was also known as Jim because his father was Michael, he died in the flu epidemic. Patrick lived in Wanganui. He was married with 2 young, small children, and he was drowned in the Wanganui River. He was actually a champion swimmer. And going out in this launch in the bar, it just went nose in and went straight down. And while he was a champion swimmer, when the bodies were found, there was an elderly man on board, and he couldn't have been able to swim. And his body was found with his arms around Patrick's neck, and so clearly dragged him down. He was a fireman, and his funeral probably was quite a big funeral. He was a very popular man, and on the fire engine, you know, through the streets of Wanganui. Thomas died of some illness, and he left 4 children. The oldest was about 14 or 15. So that left Joe, and then Joe was in Waipuk, and he died of a heart attack in about 1953. I think he was probably about 53 age, I guess. Dad was born in 1902. His sisters, the eldest sister was May, that's May Evans. Lorna Ward was her daughter. And his other sister, Gertrude, she was a nurse, and she had a convalescent home in Oriental Bay in Wellington. And convalescent home, I guess it's sort of like aged care. It was quite a large house. It's on Oriental Bay opposite where the rotunda is. The original house is still there. Everything else is sort of gone, and there's a big high-rise beside it. But she used to have probably had about 12 or so patients in there. My memories of going and staying there, she was a delightful person. And they were characters. There were some of them were mental patients, and did their own thing. But we had wonderful holidays there.
Of course, it's on the seaside too, which made it even more, even in a city.
A couple of memories there. I can remember being there in January 1940, and the harbour was, you know, it'd often get it full of fog, and it was fogged up about halfway across, and I was out there early in the morning, so I was about 8, and out of the fog appeared this huge battleship. And it was the Ramillies, and it had 2 destroyers on either side of it, and it was coming in to refuel to take the first troops away to the war. We knew that it was close because, you know, the final leave had been cancelled and the troops were around, but you didn't know where. But the Ramillies, of course, was the only battleship that the British had at that stage, the Hood, of course. That was special. Actually, it was strange because a couple of doors down the road here, he had a newspaper account of the departure of the troops to that war, and he gave it to me, and it was dated the 4th of February 1940. I thought, 4th of February, I'd never be in Wellington on the 4th of February. But in point of fact, everything was reported a month late, and it was the 4th of January that sale which tied in.
Was that for security reasons?
Yeah, you know, they had to arrive because they were gone. Another memory of being at Auntie Gert's was special. It was Admiral Byrd, one of his expeditions, and he'd just come back from the Antarctic. Well, no, he was heading down, and, you know, along where the Freiburg Pool is, there was a little wharf there, and his ship was there, and went down and were able to go over it. And it was jam-packed with all these, you know, sledges, and there were dogs, lots of dogs. And also he had an aircraft with all folded up wings he was going to use down there. It wasn't a very big ship, but it's sort of engraved in your memory. And, hey, that's a bit of history, you know. So, yeah, Auntie Gert was very special. And when she sold, it was about 1946 or 47. That was a time when, hard to believe now, but, you know, there was price control on what you could sell property for. There was a name for it, I can't think. So she could not sell that property for more than a given price. But, of course, everything you got around. I have visions of out in the kitchen, Dad counting this cash which had come under the counter. It had been bought by Brennan family, who owned the Cambridge Hotel at the time. But, you know, you sold a house in Orina Bay for so much, and you sold a pen for £1,500 or something like that.
Yes.
And Dad counting this money out. So when she did other things for a couple of years, and then she came to Hastings and she bought the Begley building, which my granny had built. Granny died in 1936, but Grandpa, while he'd been a director of the dairy company, and clearly was quite, he wasn't really a businessman. So she had the estate tied up. He couldn't do a thing with it, and it was in trust for 10 years. And Dad was the sole trustee. And that property on the corner, and also the one next door, which was Cohen's. It had Begley buildings on it in little print, but that was later taken out. So that couldn't be sold for 10 years, and by that time Auntie Gert, she bought it, and she lived there till she died. So that was Dad's sister's. Where do we go from there? Dad. Okay, he went to St. Joseph's, of course, as they all did, and then he left there, probably about 14, I think. And he went to Timahanga, the Douglases, as a ploughman. And I did digress again, because he was there for I don't know how long, but years later, my eldest son, when he was married, he rented a cottage on the property, and the stables where Dad, as a ploughman, would have had her horses, were still there. And then he moved to Nunui, to Sir Andrew Russell. And that was a big thing in Dad's life, in the sense that he was there for a number of years, or for a period anyway, couldn't mean too many years. And then he came back and he ran the family farm on the corner of Riversley Road. And then at the age of, well, he'd have to have been 21, bought his first bit of land, which was the piece at the end of Norton Road. Well, obviously, he didn't have too much money or very little at that stage, and Sir Andrew Russell backed him and guaranteed him to get him there, and that was pretty special and indicative of probably, you know, the type of man he was. And Dad always stayed in limited contact with him at times, and he was always very proud of what Dad had achieved. And actually they both died within a month of each other in 1960, except Sir Andrew was 92 and Dad was 58. Well, Dad bought that property, so he'd have to be dairy farming in his own right to be a director of the dairy factory. And he was elected in 1923 when he was 21. And he got very involved with the dairy industry and national conferences and that. He would be the delegate there. Yeah, very, very involved. And then in 1930, he was elected chairman. And actually, he was elected on the day Selwood, his first son was born. So it was always a clear, you know, the date was locked into the memory. And then he was chairman right through until he died in 1960. So that led on into Dad's involvement in the dairy industry. The dairy industry, of course, at that time, the manufacturing was all cooperative. The distribution wasn't, and that was sort of where Dad came in. And there was a company formed, dairy companies through the Whanganui, Manawatu, Hawke's Bay area, formed a company to organise marketing and to have a little more control in uniform selling to the merchants, because the merchants would play one factory across each other. There was a dairy factory every few miles down the road,
wasn't it?
So that was an outfit called the Dominion Producers Agency, and it worked for a while until the government in 1936 regulations, and they took over all control of marketing of butter and dairy produce and what have you, and they instituted the internal marketing division. So Dad had been on as a director of this Dominion Producers Agency from its inception, and then when this marketing regulations came in, he was chairman at the time, he was chairman in 36. The ground was cut from underneath him, so it went into recess. So then Dad pursued establishing the farm products in Hawke's Bay to take over the marketing, and they persuaded the government to let them do it in the sense that they wouldn't, they closed the IMD in terms of dairying in this area, and they would not allow any other merchant in there. So that enabled the dairy companies from Woodville to Wairoa, there's Woodville, Ormondville, Norswood, Dannyberg, Yeratonga, I think, Wairoa. And they were the shareholders in the first farm products, Hawke's Bay. And another shareholder in there was the PMA, Pig Marketing Association, which was a cooperative in terms of pig marketing, and that was the Kiwi Bacon Company at that stage, and they manufactured all the Kiwi products. So they became a shareholder as a like-minded cooperative. And so that was farm products established in 1937. Later, the poultry people got together because egg marketing was controlled by regulation, and they formed their cooperative and became shareholders in there. So farm products became butter distributors, egg marketing and flour milling and that sort of thing. And that prototype was followed throughout. Other people saw it, other areas, and they came in, and Dad was involved in establishing them. Gisborne, Whanganui, Manawatu, Wairapa, Nelson, Marlborough, Westland, Oamaru, Christchurch. Christchurch was just eggs and kiwi bacon, and I think that's about it. There are about 14 of them. And Dad was involved with every one of them, and that was one of the things that sort of our life, Dad always on the go, and he'd be travelling a lot. And it was always a sore point with Mum. She'd say, you know, if they want things, why don't they come to you, rather than you have to go to them? But Dad was a very forceful, he was a brilliant speaker, and he could carry a meeting. We would go, as kids, we would go to meetings and conferences and that, and always it was a real source of pride. Dad could get up there and he'd carry people, whereas if somebody came over and got their ideas and tried to sell them, they couldn't do it. So it had made our life was different, but it was fascinating because we would travel a lot with Dad when he was going to things. And once all the companies were established, they had annual conferences. And if it was in school holidays, what we'd go to, and it was great. There were memories of, it was during the war, of course, and petrol restrictions, but Dad got other allowances because of his work. Interesting, I can remember, I still have a letter there somewhere from some government policing department. Your car has been seen in Wellington. Please explain, because you shouldn't be there. No. You shouldn't have enough petrol to get there. And, you know, things were, well, you would know, travel was bad. Absolutely. You couldn't get around in the war years. But we could, and so we got around a lot of the country. I can remember once going to Taranaki to the rennet company, casein factory, Midhurst. And it was a day when the first Lancaster bomber was coming to New Zealand, and it was due at Ohakia, and we waited at Ohakia for it to come, and it didn't, and we carried on to Whanganui, and we were staying in Whanganui that night, and apparently the flight had been delayed, and the next day it was coming, and Selwyn and I, my brother, we climbed up, you know, the tower on Drury Hill, and stood up there and watched this first Lancaster bomber come to New Zealand, and two little kitty hawks had flown out from Ohakia to meet it, and they just looked like little tiny things tucked under the wings of this Lancaster bomber. Carrying on with Dad's involvement, digressing totally, but in New Guinea there was Chinese dealers and what have you in this small town. They'd buy any sort of scrap, no questions asked. And this Chinaman, he bought a bronze propeller, very valuable. But he had a little charter boat which he used to run around the islands or what have you. Next time he went to take it out, it didn't have any propeller on it. He brought his own propeller off some crafty native. Oh. Yeah. Anyway, that's by the by. Also in the dairy industry at the time that Dad, 1932 it was, they established, and you'd be familiar with this, their dairy industry insurance agency.
Yes.
Well, Dad was original chairman of that. It was established in 1932. Mm. And then that later became, they formed the primary industries insurance. Mm. And that eventually disappeared into FMG.
Yes.
So Dad was the, as I say, the original chairman of the Dairy Industry Insurance Agency, and that carried on. It was about 1951 they first started to try and form their own company, and because they were dealing with Lumleys in England. And they put a lot of work into that, and it fell over, and then eventually they got it established in 1957, and he was the first chairman of that, but he retired after a couple of years. It's another sort of entity which I can look with pride in the FMG. You still take my insurance with the FMG, and Dad had a part in it. And then the other big thing was marketing of dairy produce or everything in Wellington was largely the New Zealand Dairy Company supplied. Another dairy company supplied the produce, but it was all distributed by various merchants. Mm. And then the government came in with the IMD, and they formed a company with the combined merchants and the government. It was combined distributors or something it was called. So the dairy companies wanted control of that, and eventually they persuaded the government to buy the merchants out, and then they sold that to formed Farm Products Wellington, and the government were shareholders in that. And then the dairy companies, all the dairy companies in the Farm Products Group, they were the other shareholders. Right. And through this Dominion Producers Agency, so that was resurrected. Dad was chairman of that. He was also chairman and managing director of Farm Products Wellington. And so that continued as a partnership between the government and the dairy companies until 1953, I think it was. They were always pressuring the government to sell out, and they eventually did. And so Farm Products Wellington, the distribution in Wellington, was totally owned by the dairy farms. And all these dairy farm products companies were then brought under the umbrella of this DPA, the Dominion Producers. So Dad's next thing that he wanted, they wanted a real headquarters in Wellington and a building. So along Thorndon Quay, they bought this property, and I think they operated from the small premises there, but anyway, they wanted to build a new building. And Dad's health was getting shot at this stage. He was pretty buggered. And this was the one thing he wanted to complete. And it was built. And it was, as they were near finishing, or it was getting the process, as a tribute to Dad, they asked Peter McIntyre to paint a portrait of Dad. And that was to hang in the boardroom. So this was 1960 that the building was being completed. And Dad had been very ill. And actually we sort of said, well, he may not come through. And the painting had been done. And they packed it up and sent it through. I can remember going down to Newman's and picking it up, and we brought it home. I was married, of course, at the time. Dorothy and I, we unpacked it, and we took it to Royston Hospital, and Dad saw the painting, so it was very good. But he survived, and the painting was sent back, and then, of course, it was October that year, and the building was to be opened, and there was this unveiling of the portrait was to be the thing. And because Dad, he was still not well, but, you know, determined it was his baby and it was being completed. And of course, on the way to Wellington, there was a traffic accident. Mum lost on the Himitangi Strait before Foxton. I think she must have clipped the edge of the road and lost control, spun it around. Dad was, he wasn't well, as I say, and he was lying on the back seat. He was thrown out of the car. Actually, it spun around, and in all that miles of Himitangi Strait, I don't know whether you're familiar with it, there was one car on the other side of the road parked. I hit that. Dad was thrown out. And we got the ring at 6 o'clock at night that from Mum's relatives in Palmerston that they'd had the accident, and Mum was with them, and Dad was in hospital. He was okay, but he had a bad cut on his leg. And when we got the call, he was going into theatre to have it sewn up. Long and short of it, when they went up to see Dad at the hospital, they were greeted that he'd died on the operating table. And so, yeah, we went down there. It was a real, yeah, it was, the long and short of it, Dad, it should never have been given an anaesthetic in the inquest. The inquest said it was due to the anaesthetic. Mm. They should have been aware of his condition because they had all his medication.
Of course, today, that would never have happened because, and he probably wouldn't have had a lot of the conditions he had because the drugs of today would have prolonged his life anyway.
Yeah, but his condition was such that his doctor said, you know, he wouldn't have seen Christmas probably, so it was good. And Dad, I could never imagine him. He always had to be doing things, so he'd have been. But the next day we were down there, and of course we hadn't given it any thought at all, and the police turned up and interviewed Mum, and they sort of say, well, perhaps you should have a lawyer present. What? And they were thinking of charging her for dangerous driving. And, you know, there was nobody else involved. And so, boy, that, we didn't know what to do. So we said, well, okay. We shuffled the policeman out and said, well, you know, could we leave this for a while? And could Mum be interviewed at home? And they agreed to that. But I was dead scared, actually. A little bit of corruption. Dad, the smaller areas of police control in those days, in the Hawke's Bay one, the head of police at the time, he, Mum and Dad knew him. So I remember going, I went to see him at Napier, and I said, well, you know, please, Mum's, we don't want a case. It's not going to serve any purpose. He said, oh, well, you know, it's not in their control, it's the Man of True Division. And he said, often these things, there's guilt and they can be. He said, I don't know. I said, well, you know, if you can block it. And fortunately he did. He rang me up a few weeks later and he said, you know, go and see him. And he said, I didn't like it, but I managed to block it. And what that would have done to Mum, I don't.
I can imagine.
So that was sort of Dad's life. But he was also, with all these other things, he was involved in so many, there were so many boards and regulations. The wheat board, I remember, he was on the National Wheat Board, he was on the National Egg Board. It'd be, and it was always a source of pride, I guess, as far as I was concerned anyway, that they were all government appointees to that board. But Dad was appointed by both governments, which I felt was a measure of his respect.
Absolutely.
At a local level, too, I often think of Dad's achievements, but his ability to, I told my sons about it, because his ability to cut through the rubbish and get to the nitty-gritty of things was quite amazing. I don't know whether you recall the gas company in Hastings.
Yes.
Was owned by the Napier Gas Company.
Right.
And then they closed it, or said they were going to close it. Would you have gone to that meeting?
No.
Well, there was a chap, Mason, he was a lawyer in Napier, and he had trust that he was involved with that had a lot of gas, so he was interested, and he convened this meeting, and he asked Dad to attend, or if he could come. But Dad would, he'd probably spend three weeks of the month he would be in Wellington on business for one thing or another, and, well, I don't know whether I'll be here or not. So anyway, in point of fact, he was coming back from Wellington the night of the meeting, and I can remember Mr. Mason came round and said, you know, would Dad get there? And Mum's just sort of put a meal in front of Dad, and he wouldn't be there for the meeting, the beginning of it. So we went, and Dad came later, and it was in the assembly hall in Hastings. It was a packed hall, because gas was a big thing. Napier said, right, well, you know, they're closing it. And Mr. Mason spoke, the mayor, be Ron Georgie at that time, I think. And I remember Alec Kirkpatrick was deputy mayor, and they all spoke, and Sid Jones was MP. And a lot of hand-wringing, say, well, they shouldn't, Napier shouldn't close it, we stop them, and the government should do something. But there was nothing sort of concrete. Dad arrived, and he was the last one asked to speak. And he got up, and he's sort of, right, well, forget about Napier, they can close it and what have you. We have to do something. And if the government, sure, the government, we can get them involved, but we have to do it. He said, if you would agree, all the people here, that you'll move a motion to form a company, cooperative company. People that are here tonight, you sign up, take £5 of shares. You won't have to be called on that, but just your commitment to pound. Send out for clipboards and what have you. Pass the thing around. They got everybody signed up. The company was formed. Dad went to Wellington. Jack Watts was the Minister of Industries. Yes. He knew him well, and Mason went with him, and they made a deputation. Later in the week, Dad went and saw Jack, and he said, yeah, we'll do it. They gave them something, I think, like about 25, 26,000. Once the company was established, that enabled it. They switched from gas to oil, modernised it, and then, you know, later on it was taken over. And, you know, to me, until Dad got up, nobody was offering a concrete solution. No. And it cut through all the chaff and bang. And so that was the only time Dad was sort of involved in local politics. Although he, as a result of that, he did a couple of terms on the power board, because that took over the gas.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
So, yeah, I was very fortunate, and it was a great life growing up. It sort of harked back a thought that comes to mind, the instances. As I say, Dad had to travel a lot, and he used to fly, if he could, charter like a moth or something. And I can remember one time, got a plane just to go over for the day to, and it wasn't a tiger moth, it was a little oster, to Taranaki. And we went out to Bridge Bay, was due to be back at late in the evening. And it was getting late and darker, and it wasn't a very good weather and what have you. And then this little oster appeared, and it landed. And it transpired, I don't know who the pilot was, but I can still see him. He was all in a jacket and tie and what have you, just like a man off the street. And they come back, and they got to Ashurst, and the cloud base was low, so they finished up. They flew through the Manawatu Gorge at road level and got through, which of course was very illegal. And yet, later, there are wires across there, which this guy said he didn't know, that, or I don't know, might be 2 or 3 years later, Dad was going to Wellington for something. And do you remember Mort Vanderpump?
Yes, I do.
He was a wonderful pilot, top dressing. You could always tell if Mort was flying, because he tossed that plane around a whole lot better.
Now, your Lorna, she was telling me about Mort Vanderpump flying up at their farm at
Why worry?
Why worry?
Wonderful character. I always think when you talk flying, as I say, you see somebody top dressing, you could tell it was Maud. And it's the same way with Paul Wolfe with the helicopter.
Yes.
You could always tell if it was him flying. Mm. They were just... Mm.
They had different habits.
Mm. And an expertise. But anyway, so Dad was going down to Wellington, and it was probably a Piper or a Cessna or something. There was room, so Mum was going along too.
Mm.
And she often used to talk about they got to Woodville, and there was a sort of cloud base, and we couldn't get through. It stooged around there for a while. He said, oh, we'll find a pocket in the clouds. Mm. And the next thing, Mum said, I didn't know what was happening. They just dived. He saw a pocket, and they went through the gorge at road level. But the way Mum used to talk about it, it was all right for Morton, Dad in the front. They knew what was happening, and she didn't have a clue. No. And another one that he used quite often, Bill Taken, Bill King's pilot. And,
yes, I went to school with his brother's son.
Okay, well, Bill, RAF guy, he was come home on extended leave, and he often used to fly Dad around in Tiger Moth, and always when he'd be... go over those Taupo hills, he'd be looking for any sign of his brother who disappeared there. So there we go. It was an interesting childhood and very grateful. I suppose everybody's father's the greatest and mother's the greatest and what have you, but I think I was very fortunate. And Dad was very good. I don't ever remember, say, as kids, he wasn't a sort of kick a football around person, but you were treated older than you were, and that was always appreciated. Yes. But I think of, again, the era, different day and age, in terms of staff and that sort of thing. The way people were treated was different that day and age. Mm. There was a chap, Fred Abbott, brilliant mechanic. And did you know Fred?
We knew him as Darkie Abbott.
Well, Fred, he could fix anything, and he was invaluable at the dairy company.
Well, he was a spare driver. He only drove if, some of the other drivers were sick. Or, we all knew Fred. And then the Timms.
Oh, Billy Timms, Donnie Nelson.
Yes, they were all part of it, And the cooperative dairy company, it was made up of all these dairy farmers.
That's true. Paul Christensen?
Yes, that's right.
Well, just when I talk Fred Abbott, I always think it wouldn't happen in this day and age, but old Fred, he liked his tipple, but he could repair a vehicle sober or otherwise. But I can remember one time Fred got into an accident on Pakawai Road, 2 o'clock in the morning, and the police picked him up, he had a drunken charge, and down the police. You've got a phone call. So who does he ring? Dad. The chairman of the company that he works for. And Dad gets out of bed and goes down and rescues old Fred.
Wouldn't happen today.
No. And it's relevant. Well, it's not relevant, but it's a story that comes to mind when you talk. The cream collector drivers were Paul Christensen, and he had the two-tierer run.
Yes,
do you remember Paul? Do you ever know Marius, his father?
No.
He used to do a bit of catering. He was a character. And a great patron of the Storford Lodge Hotel. And he had raspberries down by Wall Road there, just before you got to Wall Road. So it was Christmas, or near Christmas, and of course Dad's cousin, Jack Guerin, out at Mangatahi, we used to go out there a lot, and they used to have a Christmas party for all the Mangatahi kids and Raukākahu. And it had to be a Father Christmas. So this year they asked Dad to be Father Christmas, and Dad's, that's a bit of good, So he had his Father Christmas suit, what have you. So going out, and it's after 6 o'clock, because daylight saving, long summer evenings, and Marius Christensen must have come home from the pub, and Dad just saw him drive into his place on Raukākahu Road. Oh, go in and see old Marius. So Marius says, just walking in, we all drive in, and because Dad's driving in his Father Christmas suit, and old Marius turns around, the look on his face, I reckon he was swearing himself off drink for life, he was Father Christmas driving in. He was a wonderful character, old Marius.
Well, they were identities those days because people stayed in particular jobs forever and a day because there was a loyalty. They worked hard and their bosses would never sack.
Yeah. And, you know, men were appreciated. Peter Bridgman, old Peter, he was a character.
He certainly was.
Builder. But, you know, there was Billy Connolly and chap Ron Martin. He was a plasterer. He had three, you know, different trades, key men. Every Friday, old Peter would come into Farm Products there. Oh, give us, £10 of sausages and a ham and chicken and a bit of bacon and what have you. And that would be passed on to the employees. Yep. Something they could do for them, an attitude.
So when you left school, what did you do?
That is an interesting thought. What did I do? I went into the seminary.
Of course you did.
Yes.
You were the chosen one.
Well, I probably was influenced, of course, Silverstream. I really enjoyed Silverstream because it was a different day and age, as we talked before, you're restricted. You went there, it was solely a boarding school. There was a large Taranaki element, the South Islanders. Every area had an identity, and you were there you didn't get out. The term was 13 weeks. You had one free weekend a term. So you got on with guys, and friendships, they remained forever. A few weeks ago, I went to a friend's funeral in Taupo, and, you have contacts. I still keep in touch for those years ago.
So from Silverstream, you went straight into the seminary.
Yeah.
Where was the seminary?
Over at Green Meadows here.
Oh, of course, yes.
Well, just sort of reminds me there. Dad had a lot of, government influence or what have you, and I can remember two or three times that particularly Holyoake would come to see Dad. And actually, my last night before I was going into the seminary, we were looking forward to it, and then Dad got a ring from Holyoake. Could he come and see Dad? Mm. And my last night, which I'd been looking forward to, was entertaining his chauffeur while Holyoake and Dad solved some problems in the lounge. And he said, "Do you mind if my chauffeur comes in?" "Yes," says Mum. So we had to... He was a nice enough guy, but it wasn't my plan for the last night at home before I went into the seminary. Yeah. So I did 3.5 years there, which I found invaluable. It probably enabled me to grow up a lot. I was very young. I was only 17, I guess, when I went in there, and 21 when I came out. But the teaching and, I looked to much of my life as benefits there. Then I went to Farm Products, but I only lasted there a little while because Selwyn, my brother, he was back on the farm at the end of Norton Road, and he needed help, so I was with Selwyn for 3 years. What happened then? That probably took me through to about 55. It was probably at that period, with Dad's help, I bought the 5 acres in Elgin-on Road, which had been a rehab property. Guy had set up as a nursery all sorts of... He had loganberries and black currants. And it was all just been neglected, and we cleaned it out and planted asparagus there. But then I went into Farm Products and was there until Dad died, and I left 6 months after Dad died. I won't go into that too much, but it was not a good scene. Interesting, as I said before, Dad was a very powerful character, and after he was gone, it was amazing how sort of everybody thought Dan Begley was the greatest. Now they were sort of coming out of the shadow, and they thought, well, I didn't agree with that, and I didn't agree with this, that, and the other. And there are a whole lot of very... Well, it was a major problem anyway, and the long and short of it, I left. Well, in the meantime, I got married. That's pretty important. And that was Dorothy Ryan. She'd been born in Hastings. Dorothy had an interesting life because her father was a policeman. He'd also been... He went ashore in Gallipoli on the first day, and he was on Gallipoli through till the end of July, was invalided off, and he must have been really sick because a lot of them, of course, they took them to Egypt and then regurgitated them and sent them west of front. But he wasn't. He was repatriated home and discharged. Oh, and of course, transpired Dorothy's grandfather had been best man for my grandparents' wedding in Miani in 1885. But she was born here and went to Wellington, where father was the sole policeman at the Thorndon police station. Hard to imagine that. You know, you'd have a police station at Thorndon. And actually, after we were married and Farm Products was still being built, we went down to Wellington for something or other and went and had a look at the building in progress. And across the road was where the old Thorndon police station house was still there. Dorothy showed me where she used to climb up on a box and look over and see the trains going by, because it was right by the train lines on Thorndon Quay there. That was so strange. And then, of course, she just started school at St Mary's in Hill Street, but then her father moved to Prongahau, and she grew up all the rest of her life in Prongahau.
Policeman at Prongahau.
Yes, and strangely, I saw in, you know, the Tribune, how they have the 100 years ago, there was a little item about the going out to tender for a erection of a police station and police constable's house in Prongahau in 1914. But Dorothy went there in 1936. And she had lovely stories of being the policeman's daughter wasn't necessarily good, but it wasn't necessarily bad, because she could sort of bribe other kids for things. I'll let you have a look at the jailhouse, because they had a little jailhouse that would take one customer. And so then she moved into Waipak when she was working, and then he retired in 1950, and they came to, and Dorothy and I met in 58, married in 59.
So was he related to the local Ryans?
No, his father was, he was born in Potiki, and he had been, I don't know whether the family lived down the west coast, but he had spent a lot of time down the west coast, one of a large family. Although, interesting, I do have photos of him when he was married and Dorothy was born. He was a police constable here, but he was always the mounted constable. They had a mounted policeman. Okay. There were people, Mr. Ryan, he was a mounted constable, which you wouldn't think of in this day and age. And at the races, there's a photo, there would always be a constable, mounted constable at the race, keep everything under control. After I left Farm Products in 1961, I was looking for, I thought, well, I get a bit more land. I wanted to plant some peaches. And funny how things work out, where your life could go. I spent quite a few weeks. I applied for a couple of jobs and I didn't get them, so I was out of work. And Bill Whitlock, Dad had a lot to do with him, and I'd sort of known him through Farm Products. He was always very interested in things, and he rang me up and he said he knew I was looking out of work. Went and saw him, and he offered me a job at the Tribune, which he said he was offering me a real opportunity, which I was very grateful for, but I mean it was totally out of line, and if I took it I would have to be, you know, it wasn't sort of here and disappear. I had to make a commitment to him, and okay, he would give me opportunities. Sure. Like I say, I appreciate it, but I explained that I was really looking for land, seeing the opportunity, and my aunt, Auntie Gert, had said that, you know, she would back me because I had just a few acres. And I said, well, give me a week to think about it. And he said, oh yeah, that's fine. And I'd been looking around and couldn't find anything I really wanted, bare dirt, because peaches were the things you were planting then. There was a chap, Ian Russell. Well, Ian's father, Jack Russell, had been manager of Farm Products, Wanganui. And Ian had just come over here at that time, and he'd sort of started with Murray Roberts as a real estate agent. I'd been round everybody, and I thought, oh, I'd better go and see Ian. And he'd only just started a couple of months in the job. And he said, well, yeah, thanks very much, but don't know of anything. I had an appointment to see Bill Whitlock on the Friday. And the Thursday night, it was probably about 6 o'clock or something like that, and Ian Russell arrived down with, I think it was a chap, Turley, Max Turley. I think he was out Tijuana Way. So he said, I think I've got the property for you. But he said, it's not bare land, it's just down the road. And it was Slade's Orchard, which is at the bottom. And they just sold, he said, it's not on the market yet, but it's for sale, and we'll be selling it. They had sold him a house and said, do you have something else? And he said, well, I've got the orchard to sell and what have you. So he said, what do you want for it? And he told them. So they'd come down. They said, there's this orchard there. And he said, the price, well, sounds all right. And I could probably stretch to it, but it really wasn't what I wanted. But being so close, it would tie in everything. So I said, well, you know, can you get an option on it? But I said, don't say the name. Just can you get an unnamed option on it? Because it was one of the strange things. The Slades had been there when we were kids, and Mum and Mrs. Slade were very good friends, and looking forward to when Selwyn comes back to the farm and all the rest of it. But I don't know, for whatever reason, something fell out. And when Selwyn went back there, they just ignored him. And even the years I was there, Slades would go by in the car, and she wouldn't, you'd be out on the roadside, and she'd totally ignore you, wouldn't wave or do anything, you know. So I thought, well, I don't think they're going to be very pleased to get beer. That's why I said to Ian, can I get a, you know, a blind option? So they did. They came back and I signed it. And we'll better go and have a look at the property. And we go down there and he drove it. I went in his car and he drove in, and of course they recognised the car and came out. And I stepped out of the car, and Mrs. Slade, she was on the terrace of this bungalow, and she took the steps back. Not you. And it was so clear they wouldn't have had a bar of it. So, yeah, we finished up in the orchard.
But she finally relinquished?
Well, Artie was all right.
Yes, but she was the boss.
Yes, yes.
Very strong woman. She taught me at Sunday school.
Oh, did she? Oh, well, then... When I was with Selwyn on the farm, you know, you'd hear they had a big bell out and it'd ring. It would go at exactly 10 o'clock, exactly 12 o'clock, and Artie was there.
Well, I also knew that all the Slades and Havelock were related. There was the Slades and Tamatamanga Territory Road, then the Slades that lived in Te Aute Road, the sons I went to school with were Colin and Ken and Donald. And, of course, then there was Artie with John and Donald.
So was it Artie's brother?
Yes, they were all brothers. They were all Slades. And they all lived in Havelock, but none of them talked. So you were not the odd man out.
Well, that's interesting.
They didn't talk to their relatives either.
Gosh. But, yeah, well, I have memories of there was a house, the original house there, which, as I say, I bulldozed into a hole. And Artie never threw anything out. Artie said as long as he produced good fruit, he was happy. And they stayed on in the house I think we bought it in the end of the season, and they didn't move out till probably October, that's right, was Dad's anniversary. So I sort of got I pruned with him and got a feeling for it. But it was a bungalow which they had built themselves, or he had, and that was interesting because... We did alterations before we moved in, and we wanted to change the kitchen and to knock the hole in this concrete wall. And Artie had mixed all the concrete himself, and of course we backed onto the caramel, and there was a shingle down there, and that was his builder's mix. And through it, the reinforcing was the Y, you know, for the root boxes.
Yes.
And after we moved in, we found the real problem. For foundations, the old kerosene tin. So it put a kerosene tin there and work over across because the ground sloped.
Yes.
So just dug them in. And on one side of the house, you had the full width, and the other you only had about this much. And where it was just foot or so of clearance, that was where all the kitchen, bathroom and everything. So to change anything, you had to tear the floorboards up. And then even worse, once... or two or three years later, looking after Mum's cat, she was away, and the cat disappeared. And the long and short of it, Selwyn, he had asparagus then, which we fronted onto, and he must have hit this cat with the discs, and it must have been injured that went under the house. And we found a smell, and it was right over in the lowest part. I had to climb under, and I had this long stake and rigged up a tackle to hook onto the poor cat and drag it out, and I got stuff all over my face to the smell, dreadful. So Artie, boy, did I curse him in his house that he had built.
So how long did you stay?
We were there till 68. Just to divert there, like I say, old Artie, he never threw anything out, and there was all this rubbish, and bulldozed this great big hole and pushed everything in. So we'd been there probably a couple of years, and a guy came to me and he said he had a friend down south who was a vintage car fanatic, and he was wanting to restore an Errol Johnson 1902 or something or other, but he was short of a front axle, and he tracked it down that there was a front axle on our property.
Not in the town.
And I said, well, you know, it's probably disappeared in there. But then I remembered there was a trailer that was half overgrown down in the creek. And I said, well, go and have a look at that. That might be it. So he went down and came back. No, that's a something Studebaker or what have you. He said, I'm sure it's definitely come here. And I said, well, I don't remember bulldozing an axle. And then I remember, well, I have seen some rusting stuff down in the creek there. And back he goes downhill. It was it. And I dragged it out. We put it on the rail, put on the train, and it was sent off down. A couple of years later, there was a vintage car rally here, and one of the stars was this Errol Johnson. And, you know, this, the axle from our property, never my axle, but, and amazing, you know, the dedication of people. So, yeah, we stayed there till 1968. And it was only 14 acres, and Artie was, he'd never replace a tree. If a tree came out, he let the branches, you know, had the old four-leader trees, you know, and they just spread out. Hundreds of props we used to have this thing. I can remember I had Cox's Orange, and we had 125 trees, and if the area was fully planted, that would have taken well over 250. You know, you only had 50% of the ground, and it backed onto the creek, so the effective acres were nothing like 15, and it was a long driveway. So that's why we, when Te Ari Road came up, I thought, well, we'll go out there, and we sold the Algernon Road block of asparagus and house, and when we bought out at Te Ari Road, so we were always planning to move out. In. So, to backtrack, when we got married, we were planning to go down south for our honeymoon, and I had a friend who had gone through Silverstream with in the cemetery, and he was a priest in Fiji, and Jack O'Neill. And Jack said, well, you know, Fiji's cheap accommodation, and why not come over and you could have a look, I'll show you around. Long and short of it, we cancelled and switched to go to Fiji, and we had a wonderful, was a wonderful experience. We did Blue Lagoon cruise when it was just a launch that carried 10 people, and you know, Fiji, like everything, was different then. So yeah, we liked it, and we went in 1966. We took the boys back and caught up with Jack again. He was in a different area. We always said, well, it'd be neat to go and do something, but we didn't have skills. So we, as I say, bought Te Ari Road. We were planning to sell the orchard and move out there. We were on holiday in at Stanmore Bay, January 1968, and Dorothy saw this article in the Catholic paper where they wanted a family for a plantation in New Guinea, and she said to me, did you see that? And I said, no. She said, oh, didn't know whether to draw it to your attention or not, but the long and short of it, we said, yeah, that we could do this if we sold the place, tie in well. In the meantime, I'd switched to from peaches to sort of decide to do asparagus, and we'd planted half of it, and we had the growing the plants to plant the rest of it, and asparagus needs time. All good. So we came home and there was an organisation in Auckland that we had to apply to, so we filled in the application and we got a reply saying yes, we'll be interviewed and that'll be it, be followed up. That was early, beginning of February, end of January. We never heard anything. We had said, well, we'd only be able to go if we sold the property. And it was on the market. There were various ones, interest came and looked, but nothing sort of happened. Mm. And May came around. At one stage, we did have a place at Acacia Bay at Taupo, and Barry Sweet had designed the house for us. And I'd actually contacted Barry Sweet and said, well, you know, we are thinking of, we plan to move out to Te Ariki Road and start getting some plans, because Barry was a hard man to nail down. He had actually came. So there was this chap, anyway, he had come a couple of times looking at the orchard, and he, George Richardson, he was married to Harold Armstrong's daughter. So George had come a couple of times, and he was interested. He said, but I'll bring my accountant. So they came out this day, and they went around the orchard and came and looked, and we left them to it, and they came back and he said, we'll take the place. So that afternoon, and Dorothy said, well, you know, come have a cup of tea. So we're sitting around the table and just talking about things, and the phone went, and it's the post office, and it says, we've got a reply paid cable for Begley from such a place. I said, I don't think it's for us. That doesn't mean anything to me. But I said, what's the name on it? And they told me, and no, that didn't mean anything. And then they said, well, it's something about mission service. And I said, well, yeah, probably is us. And it said, were we still interested, and when would we be available? And George is sitting around the table. I couldn't say anything to Dorothy. And eventually they went, and I told her about it. In the meantime, the post office rang back, what's your reply? And I have to say, well, tie-ho. So long and short of it, it was the one thing that made it possible, and it happened then. So we sent a reply back, and we said, right, yeah, we're interested, and we'd be available in a month. And the cable wasn't the organisation in Auckland that we applied through that we were expected to be interviewed. Mm. They were the most hopeless outfit. And they had apparently got about 17 or 18 applications, and they'd sent them over to the bishop and said, you know, there will be more coming. And he heard nothing, and he got fed up and looked through them, and I suppose we were the only one with trees, and he sent the cable. And that was May. We didn't get up there until mid-July, but there we went.
That's great. And so what were you doing there?
Well, that was a mission that was staffed by American diocese, and they had bought these two commercial plantations to fund their schools and hospitals. And it was on an island called New Hanover, which is just, you've got Rabaul at the end of New Britain, yes, and then above that there's a long New Ireland, and then New Hanover is just off the end of that. It's about, I think they say, about 120 miles around the island. It was all bush. There were these two plantations. We were sort of in the middle of the island, or middle of one coast, the south coast. And there were two other commercial plantations, one at either end. There were two mission stations, one on either side of the island, and that was it. It was all bush.
So what grew in the plantations?
Oh, coconuts and cocoa. And the two plantations were 6 miles apart and on the coast, but going back into rugged bush. And the one that we were living on, it had been operated intermittently. The other one had another New Zealand family on it, or English family through New Zealand. And so we went up there, and our one was a beautiful, idyllic spot, a little bay and sandy beach and palm trees and a river flowing through. It was about 900 acres. It had been planted originally by a German back in about the early 20s. A lot of it had been lost with the war, so it had to be retrieved. And the mission station was about 2.5 hours by copra boat. We had a copra boat, which brought supplies, took the copra in. That was about 12 hours to the main town, which was Kaviang at the top of New Ireland. That was the centre of the diocese. So the people were wonderful people. They'd had European contact for a long while, but there was no European influence. Their villages were solely native. There was no roading, there was nothing. We had no power, no... Yeah, there was nothing. I took up a chainsaw. That was the only bit of machinery you heard. Boats and that would go by. And we had the copra boat for supplies, but they would go on the reef periodically and it would be out of action. There were times, I think the longest we went was sort of probably about 5 months without seeing another European. So it was great life for family. Diocese had another plantation down near Rabaul, and the other family, after we'd been there a few months, they went and looked after that, so we had to manage them both. So it was, you were fit. You were walking around hills and bush.
This intrigues me. How did you harvest the coconuts?
They fall. You don't send anybody up a tree. And a coconut, until it falls, it's not mature. And the drinking coconut is an immature coconut.
Do they go to a factory?
Well, yeah, the copra is the dried coconut meat. But I don't know whether there'd be too much in Fiji. They probably just go to market and use them for...
Oh, no, there's lots of coconut trees.
Yeah, but, you know, to make copra, you need an awful lot. Yes, and I copra, know. The market has disappeared for it.
What I consider was lots of trees. It's not like 900 acres of cocoa and coconut.
Yeah, but the people and up there, and I'm sure they would in Fiji too, use them a lot for cooking. You'll see them, they'll split a nut and get a knife, get stuck into something, or even just sitting on it, and they scrape it, and that's, you know, for immediate cooking of an evening. Sure. Cocoa is more complicated, but copra, you're just harvesting the nuts. Interesting piece of trivia. I'm following in famous footsteps as manager of the plantation, because one of them was managed by Errol Flynn.
Goodness me.
He went up there in the early gold days, and he went on the government service for a period, and he was stationed in Rabaul, and that didn't work out, so he decided to be a plantation manager, and he spent about 12 months managing one of these plantations. Then he went to mainland New Guinea, and he got into strife. He was liable to go up for a murder charge, and he got out of New Guinea, and you read about it in his book. So, yeah, the plantation that he sort of, as a plantation manager, no problem, just get the boss boy, carry on.
And so, for you, was it a hands-on role?
Supervising, and they relied on you, they gave you credit which you didn't deserve. There was no reason for the people to work, because the gardens were good, the fishing was good.
And they had no rates or anything.
You had to pay $5 a year for tax.
So did this turn over hundreds of tons, thousands of tons?
Oh, no. We do about 160 tons of copra. When we went, historically, the cocoa was valuable. At one stage, you're up to about $2,500 a ton of cocoa. It was good money, but there were big mechanised plantations that would turn out, you know, they'd turn out in a month what we'd do in a year. It was good. Yeah, it was a special life, and it was a little window, an opportunity, because we came back in 71. 75, of course, they had independence, and even before independence, they had quite a bit of self-government.
Yes.
And a plantation manager after, well, one family went after us, but then after them, a European would be able to get a permit to go in, because, okay, it's the job which a local person could do. And it was good because we had to adjust to their life. As I say, there was, while they'd had European contact, they hadn't had any European influence. Mm. And the sad thing is Warren, he went back, took his, Warren's my eldest son, he took his son and later his daughter back there in about 2000. and the plantation was not operating. The house had disappeared. But he hired a banana boat, you know, and went out there. And as I say, we had a river there. And went into the river, and the first guy he met was one of our ex-workers who remembered him. And he said the people were absolutely blown away, and they were so good to him. You know, there were kids that he had played with as kids. There were men who had been young men on the plantation, and now they were old men. And,
what an experience for a family.
It was, because, you know, you had to work together. We'd run a trade store. We were responsible for all our health and for our plantation workers, but then your villagers would come to you too. Mind you, they're frustrating. We had two girls from the mission to sort of help in the house because Dorothy had to do the teaching, all the correspondence for the kids. And if I was away, she had to look after the trade store. They were good. They weren't great. Even the girls who were so supposedly sophisticated in terms of health, they'd revert to the other. So if you had a pain in the leg, what you'd do, you just score it, cut it. So they go and do that, and then come, can you fix this up? And a headache, you get fire embers and burn. But they had other, probably leaves and things, which were good medication.
Incredible.
Like I say, I go on forever.
So you've come back Mount to Tiati Road.
Yeah. So Tiati Road, that was good. We came back and were able to build a house. We did think actually of staying up there, but they treated you with such respect you could get illusions of grandeur. Also, the education, it wouldn't have mattered. The boys, Warren was getting close to secondary school, but was still Australian government then, and they paid to your choice of school in Australia. But anyway, we came back and built at Tiati Road. That was 1972. We moved in the end of 1972. And asparagus, it was good. While we'd been away, Alan Reed had looked after it. Initially, Selwyn was going to, and then he was busy, so it worked in well. Alan did the early cuts and got a percentage. And so life was good. Asparagus was I used to claim that I was the only person in New Zealand, and I think it was, that was totally asparagus. Asparagus, everybody had it with orchard and a bit of something else. So I was the only really lazy guy who sort of, you had four mad months and then you had the rest of the year yourself. You'd appreciate, the thing was, we were lucky that we bought that land as pastoral land, and you couldn't buy horticulture land and grow asparagus,
could you? No, you couldn't.
So we were on a different cost level. But, it was great. At the end of the season, you knew exactly what you want. You're never going to pay out a penny apart from doing the fern till you're harvesting. There's not many crops. After you climb, you pick all your apple trees and then start pruning and thinning and...
So those were happy days there.
Oh, yes. And we had the two boys, Warren and David. They both went to Silver Stream, which they enjoyed, but I wonder about, because it was a different college then. And you were weekday boarders, and, there were very little true boarders that be there at the weekend. And that was the big thing about Silver Stream, I felt, as far as I was concerned, that you... Because you were there for 13 weeks, you're there with guys all the time, you had to adjust. You accepted people, you had your friends and the ones that you weren't so friendly, but you learned a lot. So nothing much changed after that. We supplied asparagus to Mount Maunganui, Rickett and Coleman. They had a factory up there, Gales Asparagus. And their sole suppliers were Selwyn and I initially. We covered their whole thing, and then Bill Robson, he came in on it. So it was good, you could go and negotiate your own deals. Selwyn's asparagus, it was very light ground there, and sometimes you get those westerly winds, and of course asparagus starts to bend. And I remember listening to a radio talkback And something must have come up about asparagus or food or what have you. And somebody, I opened a tin of Gale's asparagus, and I know why that's called Gale's, because all the asparagus bent. I rang up someone, your fault. And then, of course, we decided to go into export. Actually, initially, Brittany Coleman, they wanted to go into a big way, and they wanted to buy land down here. And of course, companies couldn't buy land in their day, so we would go in with us 50-50. And so they were looking. There was a big 100 acres in Crystal Road came up for sale. Mm-hmm. And I remember the managing director came down, and we were going to the auction, and the auction was cancelled just a couple of hours before it was due to happen. And it was broken up. I think John Paint had bought some of it, or certainly grew trees in part of it. So they dropped out of interest then. They were sort of blocked, and nothing else came up. And then they decided they'd like to export asparagus. Okay. And then they dropped out of that, and that sort of sparked me into going into it, which was good, but ultimately bad. And of course, it was the export incentive period, and that was encouraging. Rural bank, we got loaned to suspensory loans, had all those sort of things going for you. And our asparagus production was going down, and taking the land out of that. So it seemed a good scheme, and it worked well for about 6 years until, as I say, the Inland Revenue came in and reassessed us. And so that put a cat among the pigeons, and we eventually said we'll challenge it in court, but it took 6 years to get to court, and then they withdrew, and then we had another session with the ombudsman, because they were very slow in paying up money which they owed in terms of the withdrawing from the case, and we had 5 or 6 years with the ombudsman before they found in our favour. But of course, in the meantime, we had been badly hit financially, and we sold, went to Waipuk because we could get better value there, and it was good because, as I say, Dorothy had grown up there, and I had lots of friends there, and it was a nice community. We really enjoyed it. And then we were only there 6 months when Dorothy had to fall and died. And that was, I don't know why, I still don't know why she died, because we'd never, in 30 years of marriage, been to a doctor for illness. So we didn't have a doctor, and we didn't really think doctors. But she had to fall and thought she was just sore. But then it was a Sunday, and then she had, on the Monday night, breathing, and that was bad. And got the doctor next morning, rang a doctor, and Ian Fleming, who we knew personally, he came. She was into hospital with, found her 3 broken ribs and punctured lung at some stage, must have, subsequent to the fall. They drained the quantity of blood, gave her a transfusion. She was fine. And that was Tuesday. Wednesday, well, she'll be out by the weekend, but you know, as soon as the drainage cuts out, she could be home, but she'd be bad for a, painful for a while. And the Thursday, I came up and got Mum to take her back to see her. We were at home just having lunch, waiting for the time for visiting, and the hospital rang, and Dorothy had died. And she had, the doctor had come to just check on her and check the drainage. And he checked the drainage, and she said, "I think I'm going to pass out." And she lost consciousness, and they couldn't revive her. Unreal.
Yes, some things we can never understand.
So, you know, as I mentioned, Dad, Mum went to visit Dad and gets greeted by his dad. In 1936, her mother had died, and they'd been on holiday, her father and mother, in Palmerston, and she, her mother had caught pneumonia, and she was in Palmerston Hospital, but doing okay. But they went up to visit her the night they were greeted she'd died. So Mum's mother husband and daughter-in-law were all died.
Yes, that must have been a tragedy within the family.
But we had had a wonderful, incredibly wonderful life, because with all the time, New Guinea had really sparked our interest in other cultures and what have you, and we had used the time to travel, and we'd done so many interesting things. We trekked in the Himalayas and up in the Karakorams and gorillas in Rwanda.
Yes.
And if, you know, you said, well, you were going to leave all these things till you were older, it would never have happened. So, now boys, Warren, he followed in horticulture. He had a nursery in Crystal Road, and he was always interested in flying, and he kept the flying up after he was married. You know, he really can't afford that. But of course, when he got hit in the downturn, everything went. Well, he had flying as a background, and he's been a commercial pilot. And he flew with Eagle Air and then Mount Cook, and then he spent a couple of years, or two or three years in India flying, then in Australia, Fiji, and back in New Guinea flying. He flies 80 hours, although he retired last year. He's 56, so he's on a different track now. He had two children initially, and then his marriage broke up, and he has another little girl. And his son is a chef. His daughter trained as cancer radiation therapist. Damien, his son, is a chef. He did time on the luxury yachts in the Mediterranean. Came back, and now they have two restaurants in Christchurch. So if you want to eat Italian, you go and eat at Tutta Bene in Christchurch. So Warren's involved with that now. He's the one that's had the checkered career in our family. He went off at 16 and a half too, as an apprentice aircraft engineer with Air New Zealand. Mm-hmm. Qualified there. It was a bad time with Air New Zealand, so they weren't employing them as engineers. He went into the office side of it and did quite well in cargo. Went to a couple of conferences overseas for Air New Zealand, and then he gave that away and went to the stock exchange. And quite often, if you see library footage of the 87 crash, they use bits which show David on the floor among, you know, in the old days of the stock exchange, running around bidding, and invariably, or quite often, you know, a bit will come up and I can see David there. So then he went to the States for a while and went back into Air New Zealand as an engineer, and then he surprised us all by deciding to, out of the blue, join the Jesuits. Mm. He did 8 years in Australia with the Jesuits, left them, married a girl who had been chef for the Jesuits for many years, and he did a master's in IT work. So he finished up at the ANZ head office in Melbourne until they decided to outsource things, and now he's with Ericsson's. And David, he lives out of Melbourne. David is on the fringe of so many things, bits of history, in the sense that he was at Air New Zealand, his first year was Erebus, and that totally changed Air New Zealand. He went to the stock exchange. We had the stock market collapse. The boys, once when Dorothy and I, in 1982, we went and extended the trip overseas, and Warren had done an exchange in the States on horticulture. Mm. He was still in horticulture there in Washington State. And Warren and David turned up in London, because David, as Air New Zealand, had to travel one way to get the concessions. And they decided to surprise us, turn up in London, which they did, which was lovely. It was our wedding anniversary, so they turned up out of the blue. Great. We carried on into Africa, to Rwanda, and they flew home a few days later. And they were on a British Airways plane that flew into the volcanic ash and lost all its engines. So David and Warren were on that flight, and we could have lost our family. We knew nothing. We heard about it 6 weeks later. We were in Malawi in Africa, and we had the tour. we were only going to spend a few days in Malawi, and it was so nice. We thought, oh, well, nice meal and nice music and nice wine. And, well, we won't get back here. We'll stay another week so we could change our bookings. We rang home, and that's when we found that about this, that the boys had been on this plane that we'd never heard of. And then where he lives, they've got a property out of Melbourne. He has a couple of hours commute each day. But Black Saturday fires, they were 20 minutes. If the wind hadn't changed, it would be gone 20 minutes later. Their place would have gone. I say, David's bad news. Don't get involved with David. But, and it's interesting that it was flight BA009, the flight. They kept in touch. They had a club they used to sort of meet up periodically. They used to call it the Gallagung Gliding Club because it was Mount Gallagung. And then it sort of dropped out because that's 1982. It's a long time ago. And shortly after the anniversary last year, David Googled Eric Moody, the captain of the flight, and he got a reply from him. And so there were quite a lot of emails went through, and David had patched Warren and myself into the email. So Eric Moody, when he was replying, he replied to David one time. He said, I patched your brother and your father in because save you doing it. And we had lots of conversation. Oh, and a really nice guy, incredibly nice guy. It's a part of history. But interesting, David would say at the time they weren't too bothered. He said his concern was he thought they were coming down in the sea. And he said, there's no way there's enough rafts on a 747 to take everybody. And they were just behind the business class. And when the masks came down, the oxygen wasn't working initially. Mm. And there was a guy in the business class who had he sort of had a bit of a turn. And one of the hostesses asked Warren and David to go and sort of watch him and encourage him to breathe, even though he's not getting anything out of him, drive him down. I've got a couple of photos of the plane, which when they eventually landed at Jakarta.
But, it landed under power, didn't it?
Oh, yes, yes.
That's right.
They got three of the engines might have come back, and then they lost another one. But they landed, when they landed in Jakarta, they had no vision because everything had been sandblasted.
That's right.
But he'd done the four-engine failure in a simulator just the month before, which was pretty fortuitous.
So then you turned a new page in your life, didn't you?
Yes, well, it's one of the strange things how things work out, because in 1985 I was on the parish council. I was chairman of the parish council in Hastings here, and we'd had a new parish priest come in. I knew him. But he'd been installed the previous week, and Dorothy and I had been over in Taranaki. So we always used to duck out of church at the side and go park in the schoolyards at St. Joseph's. So Sunday after we're back, Dorothy said, oh, we'd better go out the front and see Father Cody and make ourselves known, Phil Cody, and welcome him. So we did. And we were talking there, and the crowd sort of dispersed. And he said, do you know Kathy Hall? And I said, no. And he said, well, I'll introduce you, because she's just lost her mother, and she doesn't know many people. And so we introduced to Kathy. Dorothy said, well, you know, if you feel like coming out or chat or anything, just pop out. And lo and behold, Kathy rang and said, could come out. And so we were good friends for 4 years. And so Kathy was a good friend, and actually, there's probably a photo there. There's a photo somewhere taken of Dorothy. Kathy called in this night unexpectedly. She was coming back from somewhere at Whanganui, and just talking, she took a photo of Dorothy and I, and it's the last photo. It's just about 3 weeks before Dorothy died. And then our last party, our last night at Tiati Road, we had a bunch of friends in for an evening, final party and meal. Not many, there was about a dozen or 15, and Kathy and Dorothy are side by side. It's So I have a small photo of Dorothy and Kathy side by side, which I always carry in my wallet.
Isn't that nice? Sometimes you think things just are inevitable. Things just, none of us can track where life's movements are. Well, that's lovely. And so you have been married how?
23 years, next month. And it was very nice because, well, Warren knew Kathy better than David did, but the boys were very accepting. And for Warren's two children, Aubrey and Damien, well, Aubrey was only 4 when Dorothy died, and Damien was 2 years younger, so they know nothing. But Kathy has been their grandmother, and she's Kathy to them, but always introduced as my grandmother. And Kathy says, "I'm not going to step in." As far as they are concerned, they're your grandmother.
And do you still do any walking, or? Just local?
Oh, yes, yeah.
You shouldn't go into the hills?
No. Well, I was never one for walking in the hills.
In Nepal and that sort of thing?
Well, that was just
one off. That was
different. I always, just to go backwards, when Nepal was one of the things, Dorothy always liked Nepal, but I was always interested in mountains. And actually, George Lowe, Charlie Jackson was secretary of the dairy company. Well, his wife was George's sister.
So she would have been Reuben's sister.
Yeah.
I interviewed Reuben a few months ago.
No, well, we sort of interested in the expedition prior to Everest. And when George joined the Everest thing, well, he was a great letter writer. His letters, since his death, have been published. But I can't think of Charlie Jackson's wife's name. But she always used to pass the letters on, so we sort of read them. And then when they came back from Everest, and they did a couple of lectures in Auckland, and then they came down here and they did 2 nights here. So the second night, we were invited around to Jackson's for a meal, myself, but there was Mum and Dad, and Bill Whitlock and his wife, and Harry Popperwell, and Jan Popperwell, and Hillary, and George. And you sit around the table and talk when they've just come back. And that was so, that's a real highlight. Yeah.
Well, see, there's another family connection, isn't it? The Jacksons and the Lowes, and then you go to the Lowes, that goes to the Mardens, dozens of them.
Yeah, well, the Mardens, so Percy Marden, his sister was Ally Marden, and she was a great friend of Mum's. So in our growing up days, Ally Marden was Auntie Ally.
It's actually wonderful, really, when you look at these associations, and this is why this history that we're recording is about family and people rather than about stats and dates, because it has the humorous side, it has the sad side, but we hope that it ends up about people. Well, I think we're just about.
Yeah. Well, one last sort of thing, when you mention the Mardens, Warren, his first wife, Naomi, they met on Marden's orchard, peered through a tree at each other.
Joking. That's amazing.
Yeah.
All right, well, I'm going to end this now, and thank you very much, Doug, for sharing this with us.